All rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Before we begin our proceedings this morning, you'll notice that Justice Stewart is not with us. She's viewing on the streaming, and she will be participating in conference. So, the first case is 2020-1131, MR, a Cincinnati police officer proceeding under a pseudonym, versus Julie Neeson, Terhas White, and James Noe, and Alyssa Gilley. For the appellant, first we have Ms. Kinsley.
Good morning. Jennifer Kinsley, on behalf of appellant Terhas White, I will speak for 7 minutes. Then the court will hear from Professor Eugene Volokh on behalf of the amicus parties, and he will speak for 5 minutes. I would like to reserve 3 minutes in rebuttal to be handled by my co-counsel, Eric Larson, on behalf of appellant Julie Neeson. The Court of Appeals decision in this case gives unlimited power to a single trial court judge to silence political discourse about a matter of public concern. As an issue of first impression, this court should explicitly adopt the holding of the United States Supreme Court and National Socialist Party, holding that immediate appellate review is required when trial courts issue prior restraints on speech.
Counsel, let me ask a procedural question.
There was a TRO entered and a second one entered, and that was it. And it ran out on August 7th, and the case was appealed August 18th. I understand the first district looked at, was there a final appealable order? I'm wondering, was there an order in effect for you to appeal?
Your Honor, to address that question first, and then to move to the larger points.
I understand. I just want to get that first.
Yes, there was an order in place.
What was that order?
The trial court's August 13th order indicated that the July 24th order remained in effect for the duration of the case. The language is very broad. It says all orders remain in effect.
I thought the temporary restraining orders go out of effect in a certain number of days.
They do, Your Honor, but this order had attributes of a preliminary injunction. This order, by its terms, was to remain in effect while the case was pending. But let's not get hung up on what the court order was called, because this court in Bay resoundingly held that regardless of whether the trial court order is called a temporary restraining order or called a preliminary injunction, it operates as, quote, a classic prior restraint.
But had it expired by the time the court extended it? Because a temporary restraining order expires in 2 weeks unless it's extended for a like period of time.
It had not expired. By the term of the order, it was to remain in effect.
Well, but at the time that the trial court said it is to remain in effect, had it already expired?
It had expired on August 7th, the way I calculated the dates. And the hearing you're talking about, I thought, was the 13th or so.
It was renewed on August 13th, and to remain in effect through September 1st, which was the date that the preliminary injunction motion and other motions were to be heard.
Okay, so was it renewed by a specific finding that the court was reimposing or imposing a second temporary restraining order?
Yes, if you look at the trial court's transcript, the court is clear that it is restraining speech related to personally identifying MR. In the transcript, the court specifically instructs the parties and other people in the courtroom not to engage in that kind of expression. So there are indicia of prior restraints both in the transcript and the court order. And this court is clear that when prior restraints are issued and they look this way, when there are court orders that restrain expression, when a single judge attempts to limit political discourse, there must be immediate appellate review.
What's the political discourse here? Isn't it the identity of MR?
The court's order restrains a number of critical comments that could be made about MR. And ironically, as public interest in this case has grown, the amount of information that it would take to personally identify MR has gotten smaller. For example, Ms. White and Ms. Neeson, both of whom are here in the courtroom today, can't say things like, MR's real name is suing me, or MR's real name works for the city of Cincinnati, or MR's real name was at the city council meeting on such and such a date, because to do so would necessarily personally identify him because this case is so prevalent in the public domain. So the scope of this order is very broad.
But the order allowed, MR asked the court to preclude the postings on social media, and the judge did not do that. They can post anything they want on the social media about MR without saying his name. The trial court granted the temporary restraining order and joined the defendants from publishing his personal information. That's the only thing that they were precluded.
They were not ordered to take down their existing social media posts, but their future speech with respect to MR was enjoined to the extent that they would personally identify him.
Okay, but they could say anything they want about this police officer except his real name. They could say MR, the police officer who is suing us in blah, blah, blah case, is a racist.
We do not believe that the speech restriction would allow that kind of expression. But
why not?
Because that would personally identify him. People would be able to find out who he was based on that expression.
What they know MR is the pseudonym. They know he's a police officer. And they know he's filing a lawsuit. Okay, so they could say MR, the police officer who is suing us, is a racist.
The issue here, Your Honor, and these are the kinds of questions that should be taken up in immediate appellate review. The issue before the court is what is procedurally required to ascertain the scope of these kinds of court orders. This kind of review never occurred because the Court of Appeals preliminarily dismissed dismissed the appeal too quick. The U.S. Supreme Court is clear that when there is a prior restraint and temporary restraining orders function as prior restraints, there must be immediate appellate review. At this point, I will cede the remainder of my time to Professor Eugene Volokh. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm here representing amici, law professors, and media and free speech groups, and I wanted to speak to the question that arose with regard to the significance of the restriction on the use of a person's identity, in particular, a person's name in criticizing them. That's, of course, the norm in political criticism, both of high-level officials, but also of individual government employees, especially ones as influential as police officers. When one wants to criticize people, one generally criticizes them by name. Certainly, that's true of newspaper articles, that's true of public commentary, and the like. That's important for various reasons. One is just this is the way human beings expect to hear conversation. So anything that talks about people under initials seems oddly abstract and disconnected from the facts. Also, it's important for people to be able to say, oh, there's this allegation about this person by name. Let me quickly Google and see if there's some other things that he may have been accused of doing. Or, oh, wait a minute, I know this person. No, that's not right at all. That can't be him, it can't be what he did because I know his character. And the Supreme Court has recognized this, even in a case much further removed from government officials. That is Florida Star v. BJF. There was a state statute banning the publication of the names of rape victims. And the court said that is a restriction on speech on matters of public concern that's subject to strict scrutiny and failed strict scrutiny. The court struck down that statute, both in its criminal facets and its civil liability facets. And the rationale that it gave is that because the subject matter of the speech, which was crime, in that case, this was a newspaper covering a crime, because the subject matter of the speech was a public concern, the identities of the people involved in the incident was of public concern too. And that involved just a crime victim. Here we have someone who is a government official who would be treated as a public official under libel law, and that is something that is constitutionally protected and viewed as fully valuable political speech. One way of thinking about it is to think what would happen if, say, a newspaper, perhaps not, say, the Cincinnati Inquirer, a newspaper which obviously has powerful has lawyers on staff who can deal with these things, but just an ordinary small-town newspaper was criticizing someone. Some government employee, and the court issued an order saying, you cannot criticize this person by name. You want to write an op-ed criticizing this person. You write a news story. You have to use not even their initials, someone else's initials. I take it we'd say that's...
Counsel, is there any circumstance where you would see the use of initials or some other pseudonym being appropriate?
Your Honor, we think not, because we think, that especially with regard to criticism of government officials, at the very least, everybody has a First Amendment right to criticize them by name. It is conceivable, one might say, that if there is an extraordinary risk of harm as a result, let's say somebody's about to say, the undercover police officer who is currently embedded in this gang, his name is this. Maybe you could imagine, oh, that is such a pressing danger that justifies this.
You would agree under those circumstances?
Your Honor, I don't think we would. I think that even in that situation, the solution may well be that in that situation, may need to pull out the officer from the enforcement action. But at the very least, that is potentially distinguishable. One could say, to use somewhat obsolete terms in First Amendment law, clear and present danger, something that is present in the sense like you could imagine imminently, right there, they say, oh, you're that person, we're going to shoot you. But the mere possible risk of violence, which regrettably, very regrettably, all police officers, all people are subject to, that cannot be enough to justify an order to a publisher, whether a newspaper or a blogger, saying you can't use the person's name.
Well, why would we get to that issue? I mean, here the issue is really just whether or not it's immediately appealable.
Your Honor, under this court's decision in Bay v. Rasawir, TROs, as well as preliminary injunctions, are prior restraints. This court has said that quite clearly there. And under the Supreme Court's National Socialist Party decision, prior restraints are subject to immediate appellate review.
But I get that, but why would we get to the merits? Why wouldn't we just say, okay, it's immediately appealable. It goes back to the First District, and they should hear the appeal.
Your Honor, that would certainly be an important decision supporting First Amendment independent appellate review rights. It's just if there is immediate appellate review, and given what we think is a pretty clear case that, yes, you're entitled, at least in normal circumstances, to criticize a public official by name, one way of achieving immediate appellate review is for this court, which now has the record and has all the information in front of it, to take the opportunity to terminate the matter quickly. But if this court chooses to instead send it down to the Court of Appeals with instructions to apply National Socialist Party, that would also be an option.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Gottesman.
Good morning. I'm Zachary Gottesman. I'm here for the appellee. This case is not about the First Amendment. This is a civil procedure case. And it is about a TRO, whether a TRO remains in effect after a certain number of days. The appellants have appealed an order that expired more than a year ago.
Do you think the TRO is still in effect?
No, clearly it's not. By its language, it expired after 28 days.
So there's no reason that these people can't identify the police officer then?
At the moment, there is no court order that prohibits that. That's right.
But what are they supposed to do over here?
Sorry.
What are they supposed to do if they've been in the situation where the judge says, rightly or wrongly, you can't identify this person during the pendency of this lawsuit? Would you violate that? Would you go against what the judge said, even reading Rule 65?
So that didn't happen, but, and that's really what's underlying the reason we're here. The judge did grant a TRO. It was her words. The parties never criticized it, never objected to the language she used, didn't ask her to modify it. That order came out on July 24th. We were supposed to be back in court on the 30th. That hearing was continued. We were back on the August 11th. On August 11th, no one on behalf of the appellants brought the language that they now object to her attention, asked her for clarification, brought up the duration. Nobody said anything about that. They let it go. They requested a continuance. And in requesting a continuance, the court said, the order will remain in effect for the if you're requesting a continuance, or we can go forward right now. They elected the continuance option, and then they filed this appeal.
So another question with the decision of the First District, they essentially said that this was not in effect a preliminary injunction because they didn't hold the hearing, as you just mentioned, but that as a temporary restraining order, it could not be appealed. So where did that leave the parties at that juncture?
It was sort of a unanswered question. I mean, clearly a TRO absolutely expires after its 28 days unless it is extended by agreement.
Correct.
So either it expired or the appellants extended it by agreement.
So do you think that at that point, after the First District's decision, the appellants were free to just publicly name by name without the pseudonym
well,
your client?
Well, there was still the order allowing plaintiff to proceed under a pseudonym, so that remained in effect. But that did not have any injunctive effect on them. That was just merely the case caption, the case name.
Sure, but you just said it would be the order to allow your client to proceed under a pseudonym. But once the First District came out with this decision, do you think that then the other side was free to call him by his given name?
There's no longer any injunction in place. That's correct.
So they could have done that,
absolutely.
Right? Absolutely. Okay, thank you.
And it's really... We're deprived of a record in this case. The only evidence of record is the appellee's affidavit, and that was the only evidence received by the court. There was never any cross-examination, and what is attached as Exhibit 2 to that affidavit is what brought us here today. Those are social media posts that evidence a malicious intent to hurt someone, hurt his family, because he's a police officer accused of being a racist. And it started this 2 minutes hate, where everybody was going to go out, they're going to call for his job, they're going to do whatever they could do to harm this man, because he's a police officer serving his community. And that's a compelling case. And Judge Shanahan got it right. She said, page 75, 76, of that transcript of July 24th. She says she's going to let the idiot loudmouth make their social media post. That's protected First Amendment expression. But she's not going to permit publication, dissemination, date of birth, social security number, phone number, email, residence address, his kids' names, where his kids go to school, his wife's name. That's important. That's what the judge prohibited them from publicizing. There is no First Amendment right to publish your social security number, your residence address, your children's names. There's no First Amendment right to do that to my client either. That part of her decision was never vetted with an evidentiary hearing. There was no testimony. The evidence of their intent to harm him was never put in the record, and that's why the TRO is not a preliminary injunction. It's based on an evident, an affidavit, not cross-examination, not live testimony. And without that evidence, the court can't really do the job of reviewing what's been done here. And that's appellant's fault.
So, counsel, could the appellants publish the officer's name, publish his address, publish his wife's name, his kid's name, where they go to school? Can they do that right now?
I believe they can.
Okay.
I believe they shouldn't, but I believe they can.
I understand that. But you're not saying that they cannot do that. There is no court order to preclude them.
The judge has spoken on it, but I believe the order has expired by its language.
Okay.
And, you know, because things had calmed down, the need to get additional injunctive relief, either from the First District or from this court, it's not been a pressing concern.
Well, it's a little bigger than that, I think, in the eyes of the appellants.
Yes, clearly.
So is it your position, or what are your thoughts? Can a court just order people do this, don't do this, without following the rules of civil procedure?
No, the court has to follow the rules of civil procedure, clearly.
And what I'm saying is normally orders like that have to fit within some kind of the grooves of those rules.
Sure.
And if the First District said it was not a temporary restraint, or it was not a preliminary injunction, and we look at Civil Rule 65 and the temporary restraining order had not been consented to by both parties and more than 28 days had passed, then they really weren't constrained from doing anything and the judge didn't have the basis to order it, correct?
I'm sorry, I didn't follow your question.
Well, I'm just saying without a consent by both parties after 28 days, the judge's temporary restraining order was no longer in effect. And even if she said, I'm still ordering you not to do this, if she didn't cite any rule or it wasn't based on any particular motion, did she have the authority to do that?
So I think what the record bears out is this. On August 11th, when we were there, the defendants requested that the hearing, we were there, the witnesses were ready to testify for a preliminary injunction. And the defendants requested a continuance. She says, that's fine, but if you want that, you have to agree to the continuing nature of this TRO, and they did.
So then they did supply consent.
To September 1st, yes.
Counsel, did they state the basis for the request for a continuance?
No, they did not. I believe, I don't recall it. It was, my understanding now, I think, is because they were coordinating with their amicus and their additional co-counsel.
Did the trial court issue any order after the 28 days?
No.
She did.
Judge Shanahan did deal with a motion to unseal under a superintendent's Rule 45 analysis. She did. She went back and narrowed her ruling on that because of the objections to the breadth of her Rule 45 order. She went back and tightened that considerably.
So there really was consent because essentially the judge said, all right, if you want a continuance, you've got to agree to these orders. But at that time, is that when she said, for the remainder of this matter?
She didn't say for the remainder of this matter. She indicated until the next hearing for the preliminary injunction, which was September 1st.
But when she did that, she didn't limit her order to say what a personal identifier really meant.
That's right. And that was vague. It's not a clear exactly what she intended by that. If you look at what this social media poster, whose posts were attached, is Exhibit 2 to the officer's affidavit, it becomes clear what she's prohibiting. But on its face, the order by itself, I would concede readily, it doesn't make clear what his plaintiff's personal identifying information includes. So that part's not clear, but again, appellants never brought that issue up, brought it to her attention, asked her to explain what she means, because we all knew what it meant.
What did you think it meant?
Well, when you look at this, when they're doxing my client to me meant all the information about his name, email, phone number, residence address, his wife's name, his kids' names, where they go to school, all those things that he was threatening to publish with the malign intent of harming him for being a cop. And that's an appropriate use of the judge's equitable power. We don't have to wait till the harm occurs for the judge to act. That's all I have. If there's more questions, I'd be happy.
I'm follow up on the timing issue. If the TRO was not renewed, and the other side agreed to follow the rules till September 1st, or whenever that hearing was supposed to be, is there anything really in front of us?
I would say no. I think the first district got it right.
Well, they talked about a TRO thing, but in front of us, I mean, your opponents appealed to the first district, taking jurisdiction away from the trial court, right?
Right.
And then they appealed to here.
That's right.
So what is, in your view, what is in front of us?
Nothing.
Does it, counsel, let me follow up on that characterization that they agreed. Was that represented on the record that they agreed?
I believe it is.
That they agreed to follow?
I believe it is. On the August 11th transcript.
Thank you.
If there's nothing further, that concludes my argument on behalf of the appellee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We now have Mr. Larson.
Yes, Your Honor.
You go to the microphone and remove your mask.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. My name is Eric Larson. I represent appellant Julie Neeson. And in sum, as I stand here, I'm speaking on rebuttal. This is a case about the First Amendment. This is a case about procedure.
Well, let me ask you a quick. I'm over here, sorry.
I'm sorry.
It's hard to tell sometimes. So, I mean, I think what we're being asked to do is to say that, to write a rule that essentially says any prior restraint in my house issued is immediately appealable.
Absolutely.
And I understand the arguments for that in this case, but I guess I'm concerned, trying to think about how exactly that rule would work. I mean, there's a lot of things that could be viewed as prior restraints, right? I mean, you could have a discovery order that says that materials are for counsel's eyes only, cannot be disclosed to the public.
Certainly.
That would be a prior restraint, I mean, I think. But I think most people would not think those kind of orders are immediately appealable. So what's the distinction here?
And therein lies the rub with this procedurally and what makes this the challenge and why there has to be immediate appellate review. Where there is a prior restraint, any prior restraint under Bay.
So any discovery order that says something's for attorney's eyes only, it's immediately appealable.
If it is a prior restraint.
Well, that would be, I mean, if you're saying someone can't say something, which happens all the time in domestic relations courts, it happens all the time in discovery.
Yes.
All those are immediately appealable? That seems...
All prior restraints... I'm sorry.
That seems a very difficult rule to...
And I'll get to the fact that I don't think that it is as challenging as it may be in just a moment. But what I'm getting at is we have any prior restraint is deemed presumptively unconstitutional. This court unanimously in Bay went on to say that whatever order restrains speech is then a prior restraint. And the Supreme Court of the United States and National Socialists made clear that that requires immediate appellate review. So in a matter such as this, an appellate court is greatly equipped to address all the questions that Mr. Gottesman has had and raised, the questions that have been raised here about the law of the First Amendment, such as actual malice as a legal definition versus malice that someone may feel towards someone else in a defamation case.
On the prior restraint, there's a difference between, for instance, a gag order or something in a legal proceeding. This restraint was from uttering the words publicly, correct?
Yes. This restraint, and I want to make this very clear, the trial court judge did order my client and Ms. White, Ms. Kinsley's client, to not speak about this.
But why would you have to write that broad rule? When you argue Bay was a full final hearing order. Both sides were there. Both sides presented testimony. It became a final order. It's clear from that record. It wasn't based on an ex parte order.
Right.
If you take the argument that was just made, because the quality or characters of the TRO really sounded like a preliminary injunction, and when you have a TRO that really, just because you write the words TRO doesn't necessarily mean it's a TRO. If it extends beyond those 14 days, if you're doing other things within that, why wouldn't you take that more narrow approach instead of wading into trying to write a rule based on these facts? And why wouldn't you say to the appellate court that when you are presented with an appeal of a TRO that has those qualities or characters of a preliminary injunction, that would be immediately appealable? Why wouldn't we look at that as the first step instead of going to the constitutional issue?
Looking at it, if there is no ability to have that immediate review of a single judge's decision, whatever political persuasion or whatever that decision is.
So you say all TROs are unconstitutional?
No. I'm saying in a First Amendment context where speech is limited, where we are given a prior restraint, that must be subject to review so that a single trial court judge is not the arbiter of who can exercise their First Amendment rights, how and when.
Do you agree with, it was Mr. Bullock, that there should be absolutely no prior restraint on speech? Are there any time where you consider it appropriate?
And may I say that is an excellent question. That is the exact kind of question that immediate appellate review calls for. Because of the history of our First Amendment and looking at things, for the most part, speech, no matter how brutal, no matter how awful, no matter how honest, no matter how political, is accepted. And it is very limited, that which is taken away. And that is a question that is reached upon the merits and should therefore be reviewable.
Yelling fire in a crowded theater.
Yelling fire in a crowded theater is, of course, not the current Supreme Court standard. We have an imminent threat. But that's what the question is. If speech is to be restrained, there must be that extreme and valid reason.
So then let's go back to Justice DeWine's statement. Civil protection orders, anti-civil stalking orders, they can be issued by a court ex parte. Thousands of them are issued across Ohio every single day. So every single one of those orders, if it does anything related to restraining speech, are immediately appealable when they're narrow in window to then get you to a full final hearing, which is within 10 days unless the individual cannot be served. So what you're saying is all of those hundreds of thousands of orders are now immediately appealable within that ex parte framework without waiting for the full final hearing.
Yes. And I say that because I don't believe that in situations such as that, you will find a great flood of litigation. Where we are dealing with something here, something that can be reviewed, such as a political question, such as speech about these high values that we hold about speech and debate.
Well, Bay came from a civil, anti-civil stalking order.
There
was a prior restraint on that speech in the ex parte order, which then flowed into the full final hearing order, which would have extended for 5 years. But the final appealable order aspect occurred as a result of the full final hearing. We didn't take that case in on an ex parte order.
Right. With that, I would look at what the General Assembly has said as well of a substantial right. I believe the First Amendment would qualify under that in terms of a final appealable order question, if that is what you're asking. I hope I'm making myself clear with that.
So what if the order just said you can't disclose the officer's Social Security number? Would that be immediately appealable?
Yes, and I'm actually oddly suited to say that because when I was a baby lawyer, we sued. I was an associate, and we sued about Social Security numbers, and the Sixth Circuit and the federal court upheld that redaction orders would not be acceptable and that Social Security numbers are publishable. So, yes.
Thank you.
Factual piece of information.
Thank you, counsel. You've used your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.